Speak session number 10420, rule 38.
Colonel W.I. Watson, Reel 38. Can I ask about the methods in which the wounded in the action were received?
Yes. Whether to be a casualty in the line, stretcher bearers would bring the casualty out to the regimental aid post. And there would be the doctor and some qualified NCOs who would deal with the casualty, and then if it was so serious that the fellow would have to go to hospital, then he would be taken to a nearby ambulance and taken back. The ambulances had Red Cross on, and they wouldn't be or shouldn't have been interfered with in any way. And so on this occasion, however, there were no stretcher bearers. I'd only got two stretcher bearers left. There was no doctor, and Sergeant Fairley had been killed, and so it wasn't frightfully easy to deal with casualties. But somehow or other, some of the company members of the company would carry a chap back if he was wounded. Now, to give you an example, at the Battle of Marath, we had to carry the chaps across the Wadi Zigzaw to the ambulance. They all had to be brought from the line, and the doctor and the padre and the medical team had to work in the Wadi Zigzaw. Incidentally, my stretcher bearers, and the doctor, won the brigade competition in the line where we'd in the Alamein line. We had a brigade competition there, and they actually were the best. Sergeant Fairley and the other chaps, they won the competition, and they were hoping to win the corps competition, but I don't think it was ever held. I don't think there was time for it.
Was the aid post team, were they regiment or were they RAMC?
No, they were regimental. You didn't get the RAMC till you got back to the casualty clearing station, CCS, and then to a field ambulance further back, a field dressing station or somewhere like that, the back, and you know, sent to back to hospital.
In the action, Colonel, did you have any LOBs left out of battles at all?
We had always had certain LOBs, yes. They would come up afterwards. Not very many, because we were, as I say, only three companies strong.
So your companies had done rather well, considering, as you say, they were only half-trained.
Half-trained.
What happened next, Colonel?
Well, then we started. We were in this area, from where we'd started 36 hours before, and on November the 5th a warning order came through early that the battalion was to be ready to move at an hour's notice, and with my company commanders I went to a brigade for a conference, and we were to mop up from between Tel Alisa and Darba under the 9th Australian Division. We'd been put into the Australian Division by now. And that was a matter of about distance of about 23 miles. And the Australian armour and what they call their cavalry, the armoured cars, were already in Darba. And we were to get there by nightfall. as I say, a matter of 23 miles, and mop up. Now, those are the orders. A limited amount of Australian MT would be available later to be used in the form of a shuttle service to get us, to get the whole brigade forward. The battalion role was to mop up between the road, the coast road, and the railway. And these were roughly the orders. Well, things went weren't really happy, but they didn't turn out very happily. But they were definitely these were definitely our orders. We had to mop up.
Were there Germans and Italians about between the front line
the chaps in the rare elements, you see. But the Australian cavalry and armoured and tanks had already got to Darba, 23 miles away. Well, anyhow, we set off on this occasion at 10:30. The whereabouts of the enemy minefields were known only as far as some railway buildings just past Thompson's Post, just what we knew were only too well where they were. And it looked as if, to me, if we were going to have a pretty rough day ahead of us, winking out frightened Italians. And all the time we were doing this, we set off to do this, there was vast amount of traffic, nose to tail, pushing ahead to get forward with the guns. The breakout had happened now, and the Germans were going back jolly quickly, leaving, of course, many Italians behind. But at midday, just as I came to the road near Thompson's Post, there was the brigadier standing with Oliver Lees, the corps commander, who came up and was extremely angry. Hadn't we got further? Why weren't we not in MT? Darba was clear, and he was not interested in clearing the ground between here, where we were standing, and Darba. A firm base was wanted at Darba as speedily as possible. Well, now that incident was the downfall of Jos Percy, I'm quite sure. I think it was this where Jos Percy, as Brigadier, came unstuck. Somebody had slipped up, undoubtedly.
You should have been pushing forward
instead of mopping up. We should have been hastening into Darba to make a firm infantry base, a firm line of defence.
Do you think that the mopping up orders had come from Brigadier Percy and not above him?
Somebody had slipped up. No transport had ever appeared. The result was that we were to collect and sit by the roadside until the MT did arrive. And this was easier said than done, because the battalion was spread out walking across the desert sands and the rough ground. And all the time there was RAF wagons and guns and pushing their way, nose to tail, pushing their way forward. And traffic was absolutely streaming along the road. And the other way, there were hundreds of Italian prisoners walking back, marching back to captivity. Anyhow, the whole of the desert had was strewn with barbed wire and burnt out vehicles and all that sort of thing. From the bombing, really, what it had, our bombing, the Boston bombers and things, been going over in non-stop. And this is what was the result of their bombing expeditions. Anyhow, out of chaos, order was eventually gained, and we set off in MT that came along at about 3:30 in the afternoon for Garba. And it was while waiting for the MT that General Oliver Leese stopped and again and talked to me for the first time. He always remembered the talk afterwards. I met him two or three times afterwards. He was a huge, hulking figure, almost filled the roof of the hole in his car. But he was always very pleasant to me, and he congratulated me on the Operation Tuchard. But it was the end of poor old Josh Percy as Brigadier. We didn't know it at the time, but it was soon very apparent, as you'll hear, because almost within 48 hours he came to say goodbye. He was naturally very pleased with Oliver Leese was very pleased with Operation Supercharge, or with the whole of the brigade's performance. But he was very anxious that we should get to Dava. Now, our area was pretty vague. I remember we got to Dava or thereabouts just at dusk, and there were hilly ground between Dava and the sea. That's rather like a seashore, you know, has mounds behind the actual sand. And we got in after I'd made a quick recce in the dusk. And it was quite an eerie sight when you went to one of the tops of the mounds, seashore mounds, and looked down on what had obviously been a repair depot of enemy vehicles. And they were all being bombed and burnt, and they were all derelict there, and their fires were burning, still burning. Anyhow, we made a line south of Dava towards the coast, the 6th Battalion, and we settled down there for the night. The next day we did winkle out a few, about 20 Italians hiding. And during the night, an enemy plane dropped some anti-personnel bombs in the C Company area, but did no harm, and also on battalion headquarters. They machine-gunned a supply depot, which was about a square mile. It was a huge supply depot, and we had strict orders that we were not to take any of the good stuff that was in it. There were cheeses, huge Italian cheeses, about the size of a drawing room pouf that you could sit on. And there were tins and tins and tins of tuna fish. None of the air activity during the night did any harm, but we were told we were not to take any of the stuff in this supply depot because it was really wanted to feed Italian prisoners. I don't know what one of the cheeses would have fed a whole battalion quite easily, I'm not sure whether we didn't pinch one or two tins of tuna to make a change in our menu but it really wasn't a vast dump. I think the enemy air force must have known it, the dump was there, and they were going to, trying to destroy it or anyhow stop us from colouring all the stuff. But that was what I understood later, that it was for to feed the vast number of Italian prisoners that were now streaming in. Well, we spent a quiet night there. We were quite close to a bakery, too, an Italian bakery, as I say, between Dharma and the seashore. And then the next day we were still there, and the weather changed. I remember there were showers, and it started to rain. And we sent out carrier and foot patrols out earlier, very early in the morning, scouting about the sand dunes. And they did, in fact, bring in 20 very dejected Italian prisoners. All sorts of dumps were hidden in the sand dunes, in holes and caves, including there was one complete dump of swastikas, which were obviously going to be used for the entrance to Cairo. And one of them is in the Regimental Museum now, and it came out of the swastika dump at Daba. They were, in fact, ready for the fall of Egypt. Then we got a morning order. This time we were to move back into Corps Reserve, and no longer were we going to continue the chase. So in the afternoon, we got into our trucks once more, and we moved back to Daba itself, along the railway, to an area close to Ghazal, which was Ghazal station, which was between Daba and El Alamein, if I remember rightly. And there we pitched some tents, and we there heard that the brigadier told us, I think, of the huge invasion of the First Army on the Algerian coast. We heard it there. And we also heard that the bells were going to be rung at home. And I think for victory. And I remember the chaps, when this did happen, when they did ring, shouting to others, "Listen, can you hear? They're ringing the bells at home." And on the wireless sets, we could hear the bells ringing at home. And it really was brought it all very much to the whole of the fighting in the Western Desert and home. It brought us very close to each other, really.
Did you feel that at that time that Rommel was finished?
We felt that Rommel, it was going to be difficult for him. He did make a stand, of course. It seemed that it was going to be the end, and that we had to keep up the chase and not let him stand anywhere.
Were you disappointed that you weren't taking part in the
yes,
chase?
Yes, we were extremely disappointed, and always were, until we got going once more. Yes. But it was, in fact, our training, admittedly. You see, we were very short and we suffered casualties. Well, then, what really stopped us going, this is later history, what stopped us going was the very further ahead was the extremely stormy weather, which broke the harbour at Benghazi and they had to take all our transport away to make sure that the supply never failed to those troops that were advancing. And so we were had our transport taken from us.
And what was your role in Corps Reserve? Which Corps were you in at this time, may I ask?
I think we were, we were moving from one to the other. I think we were still in 13, still in Oliver Lees's.
And what was your new role now that you're back at Gazelle?
Well, we're back behind Alamein, where we hadn't just got there yet. I tell you, though, I would like to recall one incident which is worth recording. Now, I referred to poor Tim Chamberlain, who was killed, not being killed in the Alamein line. Now, he joined the 6th Battalion before the war as assistant adjutant. He was a regular soldier of the Chamberlain family from Birmingham. And he lost his cigarette case in the time of Dunkirk or somewhere like that. And his mother gave him a new one. And it had on the front, I think I'm right in saying, the Chamberlain crest. And inside it had the regimental crest. And it had Love from Mother engraved in it, Love from Mother, Dunkirk, 1940. This was the new cigarette case which she gave him. Now, he went out on patrol in the Gazala line in sometime in June 42, and you'll remember where the Gazala line was. It was a long, long way ahead of the Alamein line, and he lost this cigarette in the Gazala line sometime in May or June 42. I remember him telling me that he'd lost it. Now, it was a heavy type of cigarette case, as I say, engraved in front, with Love from Mum in Dunkirk, 1940, inside. Now, yes, the evening we got into the positions in Daba, a chap from the 9th Battalion came over to me and brought me Tim's cigarette case, which they'd found on a table in a dugout whilst they were getting into their positions. And it was lying on the table, and it was open, and this fellow brought it from the 9th Battalion to me, and I sent it to his mother, who wrote a charming letter back. And I thought at the time, you know, fate plays funny tricks. I often wondered, too, what must have passed through poor Mrs. Chamberlain's mind. What unhappiness and sorrow mothers have to bear when she got that cigarette case. I don't know what's happened to her. She must be dead now. I would have loved it for the museum and put a note of the whole history of it. But I sent it back, and then I got a reply from the mother. Don't think there were any cigarettes in it, but it was an extraordinary happening. Well, the next day, when we were back in this rare area, to the great surprise of us all, the brigadier came round over and said goodbye, just like that. And
was he most unhappy?
He was very unhappy. I think the trouble was really with the divisional commander, Crasher Nichols. I think Oliver Leese had probably written to the divisional commander and said, what's this fellow Brigadier Percy really like? Is he really efficient? And because of this row we'd had on the roadside on the way to Darba. And I think Crasher had been rather silly and said he was quite first class, absolutely splendid. You couldn't want a better, and butted him up to the sky. Well, you never want to do that. If you're giving a character, you want to give it properly. And of course, Oliver Leese had said to himself, well, he's talking nonsense, and got rid of poor old Goss then and there. I was very sorry he went. He was always very good to me, and we never had any difficulties whatsoever. Mind, his own adjutant who was commanding the 9th Battalion he had no sense of humour, none at all. And of course, he died at sea coming home. He never got home. That afternoon, the new Brigadier Beek of VC, and DSO and MC, he'd won the VC as a sailor in the First World War. He came round to introduce himself. It was not easy to sum him up, sum his character up, but I did so later on in no uncertain terms, and he was given the sack immediately after the Battle of Maris.
Where had he come from, Michael?
Well, now, Beek had come from Malta. He, I think, had been the GOC in Malta. And the governor also, Gort, was also a VC. And two VCs on the island were a bit of a strain. And so he'd been sent to the Middle East and had been at the Brigadier and been sent up to our brigade. But he was a First World War sailor. The sort of thing that I imagine happened in Malta, one would say, oh, I have said that I've ordered that PT will be at 7 o'clock in the morning. And the other would say that I've already ordered it to be at 7:15. You know, that sort of trouble.